and many of the Buddha's teachings and sutras are directed towards the monks closely practicing with him who've kind of dropped out of society and are living out in the forest with the Buddha. And he's giving them various intricate instructions on how to meditate and so on. This is often what we hear, and maybe that is the majority of the Buddha's discourses that have come down to us. And it seems that in America, and in Zen centers, such as this one, we study such teachings and practices. We have great aspiration to practice and realize what the Buddha practiced and realized as much as possible. We're aiming in that direction. And though our community is made up of people who haven't really dropped out of society, but are living in the midst of society, and yet combining it with this kind of intensive practice, especially now during practice period, coming in the early morning, sitting zazen, noon and evening, coming to classes on meditation and the teachings of Dogen also, who was talking to this small group of students about the intricacies of meditation practice. And of course, these practices apply to everyone, and many of the meditation practices, as we know, apply to our whole lives. And that's why we're drawn to such practice places, to immerse in the traditional meditation practice, often monastically oriented, the way we have this whole Zendo set up and so on. And yet, combining it with this completely full life in the world after the early morning meditation, most people go off to early morning work and about their day. So we really have something quite unique in America. This type of thing that we're doing here, not the Santa Cruz Zen Center, but San Francisco Zen Center, especially in the city center there, and many small places around the country, are similar. Fully engaging in the very traditional meditation practices and teachings, kind of somewhat advanced teachings of the Buddha, woven into a full life in the world. Like, for example, in Japan and other Asian countries, it's not so typical. There's more division. There's the people, there's the meditators who are like the full-time monks, and the lay people living in the world maybe have never even done meditation. They just come and to ceremonies at the temple and so on. So I think we have a very beautiful experiment going on in the last 50 years or so that I think will continue for a long time here in America. And so because of this way that it's going, most of the teachings we bring up are the sutras of the Buddha talking about meditation and how the Dharma works and wisdom teachings and so on. But the Buddha also taught many teachings, maybe it's a smaller percentage, but teachings that were really directed towards lay people living in the world, not really about meditation at all, but how to live harmoniously in this world. And they're much lesser known. I think many of these I've never heard of before, and we often don't talk about them, because we're like, well, we're into like the highest meditation practices and so on. And I think that's totally beautiful, noble aspiration that we have. And also, there are these other teachings. So I want to just bring up some tonight, because you might not have ever heard these either. There's a section in this anthology of Buddha's discourses from early teachings called In the Buddha's Words, collected by Bhikkhu Bodhi. a monk of 40 years or so who's translated lots and lots of the Buddha's early teachings, one of the main translators into English of huge volumes of Buddha's sutras. And in this collection, he's divided up into topics, the best of the Buddha. And this section is called The Happiness Visible in This Present Life. In other words, this whole quite large section in this book is not about nirvana and realizing the ultimate truth that actually nothing's happening and that there isn't even this present life, so on. This is like just basic happiness directly visible here and now in this present life. Very practical and straightforward teachings to the Buddha's students, many of whom were not monks living out in the forest, dropouts, but actually people totally engaged in society. Buddha taught kings and princes and people of all different classes in society. Very, very large and diverse sangha. And partly I bring this up tonight because of the situation in the world. And the situation in the world has always been challenging. But today as I sat at the Zen Center here thinking about tonight's talk, I could hear from inside here the shouts and chants of protests going on of, I think, several hundred people right down the street in front of the post office there, which, you know, the Occupy Santa Cruz movement is a little further down the street, so you usually don't hear them from here. But this is like, something's growing, it seems like, in our town. And I heard that this was a group of UCSC students tonight, with particular points that they're bringing up about banks and student loans. I don't know the details, I'm sorry, but it's I think this protest was kind of merged at supporting and supported by the Occupy Santa Cruz movement. I walked down to the end of the street just to see, and the whole corner there was all blocked off, swarming with people. So I think it's really important that we keep talking about the intricacies of meditation, because this is what we're doing. You know, this is how what we're particularly offering, I feel like, at a Zen Center, amongst the many things that we do and offer. But as the crazy world continues, we carry on this practice pretty much the same way, no matter what's happening out there. And I think that's something very valuable and very beautiful. But tonight, a little divergence into Buddha's teaching on, you know, living in the midst of a challenging and changing world. And maybe we can talk about people's responses to the, particularly how Santa Cruz Occupy movement is affecting people. And it seems like it's a big part of our town where we're living now. So we can't quite ignore it, I don't think. Also, and receiving another email today with a list of a statement put out by a bunch of Buddhist and yoga teachers supporting the Occupy movement around the country. Many people signing and supporting this, and there were some videos there, particularly you might enjoy. I don't know what I think of a video of Robert Thurman, for those who know him. He's a very animated and funny character, Tibetan teacher, speaking on Wall Street to the group with the the so-called human microphone that they use, which means repeats a line and the whole crowd repeats it back, so they don't, which they use down here too, which gets everybody on board, but you don't need any batteries. Very passionate and animated and humorous speech he gave in Wall Street to that group, supporting them. And it's a little, you know, dangerous because, to even bring this up, right, because it could be seen as a political movement, and I think most religious groups try not to take sides politically. I think there's great value in this. Thich Nhat Hanh, for example, who is very engaged Buddhist, right, has these precepts, particularly for his monastics, that really stay clear of involvement in politics, because I think even though he's very into world peace and does everything he can to support that, he sees the danger in taking sides. Even if it's taking sides as 99% or something like that. I say this as someone who actually doesn't know that much about the Occupy movement myself. But from how my limited understanding, I think it could also be seen as not really a political movement. I mean, I don't know how we define political. It's not so much against a particular political party. I mean, maybe people could make those leaps, but it seems like it's more a response about just people wanting a sane and peaceful earth in general. The protests, the Occupy protests, aren't demanding any particular move from any particular company or politician, as far as I understand. It's a movement of solidarity and group intention for peace and well-being, which the Sangha also is. So, and of course, the movement has to do with money, partly. How the country is using money and how people in different groups see money. So this is a sutra from the Buddha on proper use of wealth, it's called, from the Anguttara Nikaya. So the Buddha is speaking to the householders, the lay people. In Buddha's time, the monks didn't have this issue because they didn't have any money. And they weren't allowed to have any money, so this talk doesn't apply to them at all. Maybe some were listening in to understand more, but this is specifically for people living in the world. How do you deal with this issue of having and using money? So the Blessed One addressed the householder Anathapindika, who was actually one of the Buddha's wealthy patrons and supporters, one of the first very wealthy merchants to give Buddha and the Sangha a park to practice in, that we call the Jetta, no, not Prince Jetta gave the Jetta Grove. Anathapindika maybe gave the bamboo grove, the Venuvana in Rajagriha, which still exists there. The shady bamboo grove in the middle of India. So he was one of the Buddha's students and supporters. The Blessed One addressed him saying, "With the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth, righteously gained, the noble disciple undertakes four worthy deeds. So, speaking to Anathapindika, and anyone who's righteously gained wealth, and so, and I'd say, well, what should you do if you've unrighteously gained it? Not by the sweat of your brows, but by deceit or something. That might be another story. But he's kind of praising his noble disciple, Anathapindika, who's earned this this great wealth by the sweat of his brow and the strength of his arm, energetic striving. Now you have it, so how do you keep it now? The Buddha's saying. So what for worthy deeds does the noble disciple undertake? With the wealth thus gained, he makes himself happy and pleased, and properly maintains himself in happiness. Sometimes you don't hear this kind of sutra. The Buddha said, you should just give it all away, and you know, don't, you just forget about your own happiness, right? And you know, again, he might speak differently to the monks. But isn't this interesting? I mean, this is, you know, the ancient orthodox Pali sutras of the Buddha. This is a worthy deed of a noble disciple with wealth, making oneself happy and pleased and properly maintaining oneself in happiness. He or she makes his parents happy and pleased and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his wife and children, her husband and children, his servants, workers, happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his friends and colleagues happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. This is the first case of wealth gone to good use, fruitfully applied and used for a worthy cause. Very straightforward, and maybe kind of obvious. And this is like 2,500 years ago, right? This is 500 BC. The Buddha recommended using wealth, and still it is used in such a way for oneself, for one's family, parents, children, servants, workers, and friends and colleagues. That's one righteous or worthy deed from wealth amassed. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple makes provisions against the losses that might arise on account of fire and floods, kings and bandits, and unloved heirs. He makes himself secure against them. This is the second case of wealth gone to good use. So, in other words, he buys property insurance. Make provisions against the losses that might occur on the account of fire and floods, kings and bandits, you know, fire and theft insurance. I don't know what they had in those days. And this, maybe this was like, you just bury a stash in the ground, but like not right under your house in case it burns down. Or maybe they had barracks, I'm not quite sure. But interesting too that he's saying, don't just enjoy it here and now. The Buddha, like really, the Buddha lived, you know, in the palace, and he was being trained to be a political world leader when he left home and dropped out of society. So he knew how society worked. And after he was a Buddha, he didn't say like, you guys should all just like drop out. It's like, no. People are living in society, and like here's some good ways to do it, and they're just practical ways to be happy. Because the Buddha was into all kinds of happiness, and he would teach the happiness that will, you know, take people as far as they want to go into the happiness of the complete bliss of nirvana, and everything up to there, too. So, like, You know, don't spend all your money, and so when your house burns down, you're out on the street. Save some up. That's the second case of wealth gone to good use. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple makes the five kinds of offerings to relatives, guests, ancestors, the king, and the devas, or the celestial gods. This is the third case of wealth gone to good use. So it was already sharing with friends and colleagues, but here it's particularly emphasizing making offerings and gifts to relatives, guests, ancestors. So maybe like is the case in China and Japan, more prevalent in those East Asian countries. I'm not sure how it was in Buddha's time, if they made like food offerings to deceased ancestors, family ancestors. It sounds like maybe so. The king, meaning like pay your taxes for good purposes that support you, and the devas. So, which is also I think interesting that the Buddha, who was grew up in a amongst the Brahmin religion, which in modern times we call Hinduism, even though he completely went beyond it and his Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path were like outside of religion in a way, it was very radical for his time, he still knew, well, there's this whole culture of making offerings to local and non-local gods and deities and so on, and it makes people happy. Please continue. It sounds like he's saying. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple establishes a lofty offering of alms to those contemplatives and priests, the shramanas and brahmanas, who refrain from vanity and negligence, who are settled in patience and gentleness, who are devoted to taming themselves, to calming themselves, and to attaining nirvana, an offering that is heavenly, resulting in happiness, conducive to heaven. This is the fourth case of wealth gone to good use, fruitfully employed and used for a worthy cause. So these are the four. To bring oneself happiness and one's immediate family, to save up some insurance in case of disasters for one's household and family, to make offerings to friends and relatives and guests and so on, and finally to make offerings to the practitioners who don't have any money, who live just by the food that comes to them, which was a long-standing tradition in before Buddha's time and after Buddha's time. And so in this case, we might even say, like, even making donations to a Zen center. It's kind of like in that spirit. It's like for the spiritual community. It's almost like using part of one's wealth to support the spiritual community and other practitioners, whether or not they have money. So he didn't say whether you should divide these into 25% each of your, of your income, how they could be divided up. But there are these four worthy deeds that the noble disciple undertakes with the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of her arms, earned by the sweat of her brow, righteous wealth, righteously gained. For anyone whose wealth is expended on other things apart from these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to waste, to have been squandered and used frivolously. But for anyone whose wealth is expended on these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to good use, to have been fruitfully employed and used for a worthy cause. The sutra. I noticed that he didn't say, what about supporting the homeless or, other donations to charity. Right? It may be that in Buddha's time, it was simpler in India at that time. I mean, there were these different castes, some were very wealthy and some very poor. I don't know what the social situation was like in the town governments, if there were village programs to support the poor, or whether all the poor people decided to just live as spiritual mendicants and they got covered in the fourth category. But I think that would be a fifth we might add on, though, that I would say would not be just a waste or used frivolously. And in a way, if you count on, you know, supporting one's own happiness with the wealth, that can include virtually anything. So I don't know what other things there would be. Although I think he does mention some other things in it later. A very practical teaching of how to use one's earnings. There's various other interesting sutras in this section, also about relationships and marriage. Buddha does various marriage counseling talks. Again, you might not expect this at all, right? None of the monks are married, so it's like he's not talking to them. He even goes so far as there's a section on how to be united with your wife in future lives. There's a whole sutra on, like, you know, this couple comes and we're like, we love each other so much, we just try to be kind to each other, but we want to be together forever. And of course, this is a culture where they believe in lifetime after lifetime, so basically, just in case you're wondering, the way to do this is, the Buddha says, if householders, both wife and husband, wish to be in one another's sight so long as this life lasts and in the future life as well, they should have the same faith, the same moral discipline, the same generosity, the same wisdom. Basically, like, practice together. Same faith, same moral discipline, or precepts, you could say, same generosity, and same wisdom. Then they will be in one another's sight so long as this life lasts and in the future life as well. There's a longer sutra on this topic. Again, I also came across, there's also a lot of teachings about society in here and talking to leaders about how to govern society. There was the ideal in Buddha's time of the worldly ruler was the Chakravartin king, or Raja Chakravartin, is the wheel-turning king or monarch, which was kind of like the Buddha in the spiritual sense, is like the ideal, fully enlightened spiritual being in the realm of the world of politics and society. The wheel-turning king is the highest ideal. And not a Buddha, but like totally virtuous. It's basically, the wheel-turning king is all about like precepts and generosity and ruling for the benefit of all, obviously. So in various of these sutras, the Buddha describes the ideal wheel-turning king. You might know that story that when the Buddha was first born, I forget if it was before he was born, maybe just after he was born, a wise fortune teller came and said, "Oh, this is a very auspicious birth. This young baby, I can see, will have one of two destinies. Either he will become a Buddha, fully enlightened one, savior of the world, or he will become a Chakravartin king, they'll turn king and be like a greatly beneficent ruler over the world. And of course his father, the king, is like, yeah, you're gonna do that. But that's how the story goes, that the Buddha's father says, I don't want him to see any of these like wandering monks because he might want to go do that. And like, here he has this potential to be a wheel-turning king, and that's like, that's my thing. And I want him to do my thing. So, of course, the Buddha didn't. But maybe he would have been an amazing ruler of all of India. There's a sutra on the wheel-turning monarch. And then there's a sutra on called Bringing Tranquility to the Land. So this might be a sutra that that when the Occupy Santa Cruz people wake up in the morning in their tents, they could gather together and chant this sutra together. Maybe I'll bring it down there if they'd like to chant this. It's kind of like how a person ideally governs the land, which is, I think, what this movement is hoping for and wishing for. So this is the Brahmin Kutadanta came to the Blessed One and said, please explain how to make a big sacrifice. He wants to make a big sacrifice. Listen well, Brahmin. Pay proper attention and I will explain. Brahmin, once upon a time there was a king called Mahavijita. He was rich, of great wealth and resources, with an abundance of gold and silver, of possessions and requisites, of money and money's worth, with a full treasury and granary. And when King Mahavijita was reflecting in private, the thought came to him, I have acquired extensive wealth in human terms. I occupy a wide extent of land which I have conquered. Let me now make a great sacrifice that would be to my benefit and happiness for a long time. And calling his chaplain, he told him his thought. I want to make a great sacrifice. Instruct me. Venerable sir, how may this be to my lasting benefit and happiness? The Buddha is telling a story about this ancient king and his chaplain giving him advice. The chaplain replied, Your Majesty's country is beset by thieves. It is ravaged. Villages and towns are being destroyed. The countryside is infested with brigands. If Your Majesty were to tax this region, that would be the wrong thing to do. In other words, people are already having a lot of trouble. There's already all this robbery going on because people are poor. And there's a lot of unrest. So I wouldn't suggest raising the taxes on these people now. So interesting, isn't it, that 500 BC there were these same kind of issues and they had taxes and so on in the other side of the world. Suppose Your Majesty were to think, I will get rid of this plague of robbers by executions and imprisonment, or by confiscation, threats, and banishment. The plague would not be properly ended. So the chaplain saying, well, let's just like wipe out all this problem by just kill everyone basically and put everybody in jail. And wouldn't that be a good thing to end this plague? And the chaplain says, no, I don't think you should tax them. I don't think you should kill them and put them in jail. Those who survived would later harm Your Majesty's realm. However, with this plan, he's about to tell him, you can completely eliminate the plague. To those in the kingdom who are engaged in cultivating crops and raising cattle, let Your Majesty distribute grain and fodder. To those in trade, give capital. to those in government service assign proper living wages. Set a minimum wage and maybe raise it. Then those people, being intent on their own occupations, will not harm the kingdom. Your Majesty's revenues will be great. The land will be tranquil and not beset by thieves. And the people, with joy in their hearts, playing with their children, will dwell in open houses. A beautiful vision for the world that is not what the king's first response would be, to like get rid of these problems. Well, wouldn't it be easier to just arrest them and or execute them and raise taxes? It's kind of like the opposite. Well, really, like, give them more capital if they're in trade. Give them more grain and fodder if they're raising crops and raising cattle. You know, get the economy rolling again by like supporting the workers at the kind of like who are providing the food and basic resources, and assign proper living wages. So then the whole society from the bottom up will actually support you, King. And then you'll actually, more wealth will come in this way. The counterintuitive though it is, Your Majesty's revenues will be great, the land will be tranquil and not beset by thieves, and the people with joy in their hearts playing with their children will dwell in open houses. And saying, so be it, the king accepted the chaplain's advice. He gave grain and fodder to those engaged in cultivating crops and raising cattle, capital to those in trade, proper living wages to those in government service. Then those people, being intent on their own occupations, did not harm the kingdom. The king's revenues did become great. The land was tranquil and not beset by thieves, and the people with joy in their hearts playing with their children dwelled in open houses. They all lived happily ever after. The Kutadanta Sutta from the Long Discourses of the Buddha. How did the Buddha convince this king, though? Actually, it was the chaplain of the king. He said, I don't think it's going to work that way. And maybe we could see some people like, maybe some of these people downtown who are saying it hopefully peacefully, I don't think it's going to work the way that it's, that the 1% is maybe trying to make it work right now. It's just something, it doesn't seem to be going in the right direction. Maybe there's other ways. And it's very important that they, if there's this steady force of suggestion of alternative ways, that it be done with great peace and non-violence. And so in this Robert Thurman speech on Wall Street, that's what he most emphasized. And he praised the people for being non-violent. You've been amazingly non-violent, and it must stay this way. Not only non-violent, but don't be angry. Actually have compassion. He went into a kind of humorous and slightly cutting description of the 1%, where he described what their life might be like, and it's like, and you see, like, actually, they're suffering much more than you all. So, please, as you keep calling for change, please have great compassion for 100% of the people and beings on this earth. So, any thoughts, comments, and maybe ideas for you know, what's our practice response to the situation in the world, which is vastly complicated, but particularly in our hometown here, this movement that seems to be growing and not going away, and has, since it's not asking for any particular thing, it seems hard to see how it's going to dissolve as the winter goes on in a tent city there. Yes, Patrick. Being peace. Yes. I know a Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which is based in Berkeley or Oakland. I know of a national organization founded by Robert Aitken Roshi and others. They have a strong statement of support for this Occupy movement, and because they're right in town there, with next to Oakland, which is a big one, they have people out there, I think every day, sitting zazen, and that's their response. They're so peaceful that they're not actually even like chanting any slogans. I don't know if they have signs, but basically they, with the other people, when maybe a lot of noise going on and maybe some intense things happening up there, sitting zazen, just bearing witness in silent support. I think any movement like this, you know, it's very multifaceted, because it's not any one person, it's many, many people with many different views, and I think that's part of the beauty of this movement. It's not led by any particular organization, which is kind of unusual. And the whole, it says a national movement, and actually a worldwide movement too, it is totally ungoverned and naturally evolving, and very consciously trying not to have any hierarchy. You know, these general assembly meetings every day, and I went to one of them just to see how they do it, and it's very beautiful. You know, they have various forms they use to maintain the democracy of it. And Shoho, my partner, likes to cook big pots of soup and go feed them down there too. So they're trying to live as kind of a village. But it's interesting because it's a lot of the people in Santa Cruz who are already homeless in Santa Cruz, many, many people, right? And they have to like trek way up behind campus every day to camp. But now they can stay in town, you know? So it's like there's an interesting phenomenon in a town like this where you have many people camping. Already many people were camping illegally, and now they're, for the time being, they're legally able to camp right in the center of town. So so how much are they actually behind the intention of this movement? How much is it just an opportunity to camp in town? It's an interesting situation. But they do seem to be working quite harmoniously. And they have their difficulties because they have less forms than we do. In the Zendu, in the Zendo. It's a loose-knit bunch, but with the forms that they do have, if somebody starts to speak up too, like, violently or aggressively, the whole group kind of consumes them, you know, as a group, basically stops violent energy in a very beautiful way. Yeah. Well, we might think they'll use it for some bad purpose. In that community. Yeah. Yeah. That's a really interesting point. Yeah. 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 And it has, because the purpose is very non-specific and very broad. And in fact, I think it's quite easy for people to get on board with the general sense of, like, we want a healthy and equitable world. And I think you're right that a lot of the homeless in Santa Cruz get very isolated and are basically always threatened by the law and need a place to stay and various circumstances that have led to them being such. But yeah, there is, I think, a sense of community there that's quite interesting. That people who maybe wouldn't come together in community with actually rules, even, like they have a sign at the entrance to their camp down there with the teepee and all the tents, right? A big sign like, no drugs, no alcohol, no violence. And I think these might not be followed exactly to the letter, but they make it very clear that there's a group intention to keep it that way. They're trying to form a community with some few basic precepts. And yeah, I think I hadn't thought of that before, but I think it might be a quite healthy thing for the homeless community. It'll be interesting if it gets disbanded at some point, what will happen with that afterwards. And giving when we don't know what's best, of course, like giving capital. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's the translator here, also a few years ago started this group called Buddhist Global Relief. And they're a group similar to like Oxfam. I think it's Buddhist Global Relief. And it's about basically world hunger. And it's really grown. It's quite a large organization now. And they, like a lot of these groups that are trying to not just give money to a poor country, but like set them up with the tools they need and the seeds they need to plant. Make them, create a sustainable situation so that they can carry on. And so, we maybe wish this for the homeless too. They actually need more like a job and job training than just like a dollar for the next beer to get through the day. And yet, I personally go back and forth on this sometimes, but my general take is like, just the act of giving itself. We can't, whatever they tell us we're going to do with it, we don't know. So just if somebody's in need, and often it's like they're holding out their hand in monetary need, but the feeling I often have is what they really want is something, some acknowledgement and contact. So, and sometimes that comes in our society, especially through money or food or something. So there's joy in giving. And I think that's why the Buddha says there's these four uses of wealth, and they're conducive to happiness because it is joyful to give. I find usually when I hesitate to give to homeless, for example, it's often like it's a kind of a negative mind state for me, usually, to some extent. There's some judgment going on or assessment, and like, maybe not. Whereas if I'm not quite sure, but then I just give anyway, it's usually for myself a more positive mind, I notice. It's tricky though, this area. Spontaneously. I think it's really important and a wonderful thing that at Santa Cruz Zen Center we have this global sangha that's you know, in our own small way, however we do, making this physical weekly effort to actually make the food and give to people. I think that basic thing too is like everybody needs to eat. And giving food to people in whatever way is possible is just one of the greatest gifts. And the nice thing about it too is like you can't get attached to it. Like, oh, that, you know, you go into the person's house and like, oh, they framed the food and put it up on the wall, and like, and if they didn't, I'd be like, well, what did they do with it? It's like, it's a gift that you have to like let go of immediately because it just disappears. And the nice thing about it, and I know to watch y'all work for like hours on Friday mornings cooking those huge pots of soup, and then just like half an hour later come back and they're empty. Like, the fruits of the labors are given away and consumed. Oh. So, that's some thoughts on Buddha's teaching for living in the world. In a complex world, complex back then, complex now. Suffering being then, suffering beings now. Inequity then, inequity now. And the happiness and generosity manifested then and now. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way.